Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, encouraging businesses to hire workers with disabilities. Information about the benefits of hiring people with a wide range of disabilities is available on the web at lookatmyability.org. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capital Report.
Florida education officials want to take a look at all the tests public school kids are now required to take.
We're moving ahead, and we expect that our students will take those assessments and do very well on those assessments.
Also this week, after a recent court ruling, some are pursuing a bill to help certain victims use secret recordings in court.
No sexual assault victim should have to ask their predator, their abuser, for permission with anything in life. And that's why I'm putting this bill forward.
We'll also check in with lawmakers and lobbyists to find out what some of the hot-button topics may be during the 2015 legislative session. We'll also hear about a Florida college football bowl game that's getting a new name for the upteenth time. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capital Report. Months of criticism against the state's standardized testing systems has culminated in the Florida Department of Education's call for a review. Lynn Hatter reports throughout the year, parents and school districts have raised concerns that the state is not prepared for massive changes going into effect this school year.
The 2014-2015 school year marks the convergence of three issues that are riling Florida's educational system. Number one, students will have to take end-of-course exams in each subject and grade level. Number two, Florida has done away with its Florida Comprehensive Assessment Test and is ushering in a new exam called the Florida Standards Assessment, which will be administered to students in the spring. And number three, that assessment is tied to new student learning goals called the Florida Standards, which schools are still struggling to get a handle on.
My rule of thumb is when you get a new curriculum, it takes 1 year to get the feel of the curriculum. It takes 2 years to really get in to know the curriculum, and then 3 years you are perfecting it.
Nicole Roddenberry is a teacher at Jefferson County Elementary School in one of the lowest performing districts in the state. This year, the new Florida standards are fully in effect. Jefferson, like other districts, is struggling to get everything in place in time, and the rush to teach the new standards and prepare for new exams has led several districts to pass resolutions opposing standardized testing. Meredith Mears, who heads the group Florida Parents Rise, opposes Common Core and the new Florida standards.
Well, I think they're actually doing it because so many parents have been complaining and saying that they're going to be opting their children out of the assessment. Now, you have the school board saying it's the state's fault, but then you have the state school board saying it's the local districts with too many tests. So it's just another shifting of blame.
The frustration has caught the attention of elected state officials. On the campaign trail, Governor Rick Scott promised a review of standardized testing, and the Florida Department of Education says it will now review the implementation of the Florida Standards and the Florida Standards Assessment. Education Commissioner Pam Stewart says testing will go forward in the spring.
We have no anticipation that things won't work. We have every indication that we are prepared. The assessments are ready, and our students are prepared, and so we're moving ahead, and we expect that our students will take those assessments and do very well on those assessments.
Meanwhile, Senate President Andy Gardner has said the jury is still out on whether the state tests too much.
You've got two camps. You've got those that don't want any testing and don't want accountability, but then you have those that may have a legitimate issue when it comes to overtesting. And you have to start with defining testing.
This is something that we've been interested in for a few years, and we're glad to see that it's getting the attention it deserves.
Allison Albuchon is a spokeswoman for the Foundation for Excellence in Education. It's the group founded by former Governor Jeb Bush, who also created the state's current school grading system. She says there is such a thing as too many tests, and she advocates for fewer but better assessments.
Sure, I think taking a closer look at testing will help ensure we're not testing for the sake of testing, but testing in a way that supports student learning, which is the goal.
The tectonic plates that underpin Florida's school accountability system have been fluctuating over the past several years as schools and parents push back against what they see as a testing system gone awry. The dispute over testing has also created some strange bedfellows, with Tea Party groups joining forces with those who traditionally support public schools to oppose testing. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Florida is one of 11 states requiring that both parties know when their conversation is being recorded and also consent to that recording. At least one lawmaker has followed through on an abuse survivor's vow to make sure legislation was filed to allow young victims to use private recordings in sex abuse cases. Sasha Cordner reports it follows a recent Florida Supreme Court ruling that will now allow a man convicted of abusing his stepdaughter to get a new trial after she taped an incriminating conversation without his consent.
The case revolves around a girl who at 16 privately recorded a conversation between herself and her stepfather, Richard McDade. According to the court documents, while he didn't use sexually explicit language, he, quote, appeared to be asking her to have sex with him. And if she didn't, he'd be, quote, physically sick. He also indicated that he was doing her a favor by not telling her mother, otherwise the victim would be taken back to Mexico. And reading from the brief, sex abuse survivor Lauren Book says there are many other things wrong with this case, including the fact that McDade was an ice cream truck driver who had ready access to kids.
Even so, in the beginning, when you start reading, red flags all over the place. Never had sex with intercourse with his wife. The wife did not believe her daughter, brought her to a doctor. The doctor never reported the suspected abuse. Two members of clergy from her church did not report the abuse. How many times was this young girl going to be denied justice?
For 6 years, until she was 16 years old, Book survived the abuse of her nanny. Since then, she's been a victim's advocate, holding events and working with lawmakers to help abuse victims. And the 2015 legislative session will be no different, especially, she says, after the Supreme Court decision. In it, the justices agreed they couldn't allow the girl's evidence against her stepfather because it would create an exception to Florida's two-party consent rule, and they said that's, quote, a matter for the legislature. And with no DNA or physical evidence to support the victim's claims, the case hinged on the recorded conversation.
You know, it's a truly horrific decision. While I can understand, I'm just so disappointed at the ruling. We should all be disappointed in the ruling, but we'll work very, very hard with our legislature to create the change so that this young girl and others can find justice.
Among those lawmakers Book is working with is Coral Springs Democratic Representative Jared Moskowitz. He recently filed the House bill creating an exemption that allows victims age 16 or younger to use secret recordings as evidence in court.
You know, technology has changed. The reason we're having this conversation is the statute was written in a time when people didn't have a tiny recording device in their pocket. And now that children, some as young as the age of 9 and 10, you see with cell phones, why don't we use these devices to help protect them that can put their offender away? A lot of times, these things become he said, she said. And no one believes a kid. An adult comes in and says it's not true, nobody believes the child. And this will be incontrovertible evidence that a jury will be able to weigh.
While he hasn't yet encountered any opponents to the bill, Moskowitz says he may anticipate some resistance, though the bill is bipartisan in nature.
I wanted to put a bill forward that addressed this particular instance so that you could minimize potential the First Amendment argument that the opponents of a bill like this will make, that we're infringing on their First Amendment. Well, my attitude is, you know, all of the rights that you're granted have a limitation. And if you're going to abuse a child, you lose your First Amendment rights.
And he adds, while the bill for now centers around a certain age group, he sees it as sort of a pilot.
A lot of the times it's easier to get something on the books, test it, and then expand the scope of it going forward. So if they wanted to expand it, if the legislature sees this and wants to expand it to all sexual abuse victims, no matter the age, they could do that.
Meanwhile, Book indicated that in addition to Moskowitz, she's also working with Fort Walton Beach Republican Representative Matt Gaetz and former Senate Majority Leader Elizabeth Beniquisto on this bill. And Book says she would love to reach out to the girl involved in this case.
We want to also respect her privacy, but as we prepare for the walk, you know, this is a young girl who we, of course, want to empower. To have her voice heard and to feel that there are people out there who love and care about her and believe in the things that she has to share about. You know, my abuse was very similar to hers in that I was 10 years old until I was 16 every day. And so I want to ensure she knows that she's not alone. And so that is something that we would look forward to.
On top of pursuing some other legislation, Book says she's also preparing for her 6th annual 1,500-mile Walk in My Shoes journey across the state to help spread awareness and help survivors heal. It starts at the southernmost point in Key West on March 14th and will end on the steps of the old Capitol building in Tallahassee on April 22nd. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Still to come on Capitol Report, what do key lawmakers want to see happen when they return to Tallahassee in early March?
Really make sure that, the conservation of land and water, these type of things, are truly made a priority.
As the legislative session nears, other stakeholders across the state are publishing their legislative priority wish lists.
I would imagine everybody's got a carve-out that they're going to want.
Size does matter, at least when it comes to beer. For years, craft brewers have been asking to sell beer in large bottles called growlers. In the next legislative session, will they get their wish?
But we'd like to see the change. We'd like to get the free the 64-ounce growler.
And a Florida college football bowl game has been going through something of an identity crisis. The legislature's top priority, in fact, their only must-do priority each year, is the state budget. But along the way, Governor Rick Scott and legislative leaders will try to bend the House and Senate to their will and their own top priorities, as we hear from Jim Ash.
Expect Governor Rick Scott to trumpet familiar themes in the coming session. According to a spokeswoman, he intends to continue focusing on job creation, lowering taxes, and education. Right out of the starting gate, Senate President Andy Gardner says he will honor former Senate President Don Gates by imposing stronger safeguards for greyhounds at racetracks. The issue was pushed unsuccessfully by Gates' wife as part of a larger debate on gambling.
One thing I can tell you, the first week of session, we will send the injury reporting bill to the House. And it'll be named after Mrs. Gates.
Gardner is a father of a child with special needs, and he says one of his top priorities is to continue working on their behalf.
You know, it's an issue, I own it, and I'm not going to shy away from it.
But Gardner says he knows broader, more contentious issues await. He expects the Senate to weigh in on gambling, medical marijuana, water issues, and the process for compensating victims of state negligence, so-called claims bills. In the House, Speaker Steve Crisafulli is putting water at the top of his agenda. At first, he was coy, declining to name specifics, but some of his plans are beginning to surface as the session draws closer. Amendment 1, the initiative authored by environmental groups, forces lawmakers to set aside as much as $500 million for conservation programs. Crisafulli wants to set aside some of that money for community water projects that would support commercial and residential development. He says he isn't worried about the inevitable pushback from environmentalists.
You know, you look at the drafting of that amendment, and now it's up to us to interpret the intent.
Minority Democrats are planning to do more than lob rhetorical hand grenades, promises House Democratic leader Mark Pafford. When it comes to Amendment 1, Pafford says some of the money should be set aside to remove leaky septic tanks that threaten the water supply. Mostly, Pafford says, Democrats are going to be watching to make sure that the money isn't siphoned off into other areas of the budget.
We want to see that those dollars are used to supplement and to, you know, really make sure that, the conservation of land and water and these type of things are truly made a priority.
Pafford wants education policy to be more forward-looking. He is proposing that lawmakers draw up 5-year plans for education spending, the same way transportation projects are funded. He isn't the only legislative leader who wants to model transportation spending. Gardner is toying with the idea of using the same 5-year method for water policy. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
'Twas the day after Christmas, and all through the Florida State House, not a lawmaker was stirring. Not even, we assume, Clearwater Republican Representative Chris Sprouse. But as Regan McCarthy reports, the lobbyists were busy readying their priority lists with the hope legislative leaders would fulfill their every wish.
What are you looking for Christmas this year, Cohen? A choo-choo train? Ho, ho, ho! A classic! Do you like Thomas?
A train is tops on the list for groups like All Aboard Florida, too. All Aboard Florida is pushing an intercity passenger rail project that would connect Miami to Orlando. All of that comes at the dismay of groups who are wrangling lawmakers to help them block the plan. And those groups aren't the only ones making their legislative wishes clear. Tis the season. Government watchdog group Florida Tax Watch is hoping for a new accounting and financial management system this session. That's how the state processes payroll, retirement, and unemployment payments. Tax Watch says Florida's current system is out of date.
This is the equivalent of using a CPA to file your taxes and to pay your employees, who still uses a Walkman as their music delivery system. These are massively outdated technologies, and we need to update them.
That's Robert Weissert, Chief Research Officer and General Counsel for Florida Tax Watch. Replacing the state's accounting program is just one of more than a dozen ideas Tax Watch proposed. Weissert says the suggestions meet at the intersection of cost savings and increased government efficiency. Over the years, Tax Watch officials say the Florida government has saved $4 billion by implementing the group's ideas. And Weissert says there's no reason this year should be any different. Besides, he says, the group will have plenty of chances to make its wishes known.
There are other issues that will be discussed by the legislature, other issues that have been put out by Florida Tax Watch, other issues that these incredibly knowledgeable and public service-minded individuals around me will have on their own and through Florida Tax Watch. This is not the only publication Tax Watch produces. We produce an average about one a week.
And Tax Watch isn't the only group feeling confident it'll get the legislature's ear this year. League of Women Voters President Deirdre McNabb says while her group might be on the state's naughty list, she's expecting more than a lump of coal this session.
When you say we're on the naughty list, we have been litigating for a number of years regarding fair districting and ending gerrymandering. But the fact is we have very good relationships with the legislature, and I actually believe that all three of these goals are accomplishable. Why? Because there are such wide-ranging groups that are also in support. These are things that make sense.
The League's top three priorities this session include a plan to expand Medicaid to cover low-income Floridians who would qualify under federal guidelines but don't meet the current state standards, as well as a push to ensure what McNabb calls a well-planned implementation of Amendment 1, which earmarks certain money for environmental spending. And then there's a bill that would let people register to vote electronically. Meanwhile, despite receiving legislative wish lists from stakeholders across the state, Senate President Andy Gardner told a group of reporters just before Christmas he hadn't checked the lists yet. Not even once.
All we're doing right now is going through the bills that get filed and referring them to committee. And getting ready to go home and do Christmas shopping.
Gardner says he's not sure yet whether he'll be partnering with House Speaker Steve Crisafulli to create a joint list of legislative priorities, but he does say he'll be looking to the lawmakers and committee chairmen to drive the session's agenda. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Well, after hearing about all those public policy issues, some of us may need to drink. Craft brewing in Florida is big business and getting bigger, but many within the community are unhappy about a certain size restriction. In Florida, it is legal to fill large bottles known as growlers, just not in the industry standard size of 64 ounces. Nick Evans reports the craft brewing community is mobilizing again this year to get rid of the size regulation.
What do you want in your
growler? I'm usually more of an IPA guy, and I like to go with, I start with an Imperial IPA and then work my way down.
Okay, great. And what do you want in your growler?
I really like Belgian beers. I like Saisons and Belgian triples and quads because
this is
so
Mike and Bobby Carbonell. They're brothers, and they run a little shop called Growler Country. Here's Bobby again.
Growler Country is a growler filling station. We're one of the first in the state that we offer craft beer from local and national craft breweries for here in pints and to go in growlers.
Behind the bar, they've got 24 taps, and next to the register, they've got their growlers lined up. When someone comes in, they can buy a new bottle and have it filled or drop off their old one in exchange for a clean bottle, kind of like how it was when the milkman made house calls. And that kind of homey feeling extends throughout the store. Really, it feels more like your buddy's garage than a bar. It's comfortable, not too loud, well lit. But it is missing one thing.
So in Florida, we're only allowed to fill anything up to 32 ounces or over 1 gallon. So we only for our store, we only carry 32-ounce growlers and 128-ounce growlers. We can't do anything in between.
And while not having the 64-ounce option isn't destroying his business, Bobby does support removing the regulation.
But we're doing okay with the 32 and 128, but we'd like to see the change. We'd like to get to free the 64-ounce growler.
And people have been trying to free it for years. Results have been, well, let's just say mixed. Earlier this year, Lakeland Republican Senator Kelly Stargell proposed a bill that allowed growlers, but brought a whole host of other regulations along with it. Fellow Republican Senator Jack Latvala was highly critical of the bill. Here he is last April, just after it passed the Senate.
As a Republican, I'm supposed to be about, we're supposed to be, as Republicans, about free enterprise, about leaving the market alone, and, you know, we don't practice what we preach.
The bill died in the House shortly thereafter. In the coming session, Latvala is working on growler legislation. And to do so, he's teaming up with newly elected Republican Representative Chris Sproles. Here's Sproles describing the issue as he sees it.
If people want to buy the product, which clearly they do, if people want to buy a 64-ounce growler, then you know, where's government going to come in here and step in and say, well, you know, why do you need the 64? They want to purchase it. So it is stifling business if you have a product and people want to buy it and they're unable to.
Part of the problem with earlier attempts, Sproles says, is the bills were too expansive.
Our view is that this piece of legislation should be a standalone bill that affects the growler and only the growler.
And Sproles has good reason. Critics of the bill that failed last session suggested lobbyists for major beer distributors, a group that has long opposed allowing growlers, were pushing for extra regulations to either sink the bill or get special considerations. But now it appears that might not be an issue.
We're mobilizing an industry-wide coalition to make this new container size legal. No strings attached.
That's a video produced by the Beer Industry of Florida, a lobbying group that represents distributors primarily focused on Miller Coors products. If they do in fact stand down, or even lobby in favor of growler legislation, then the big bottles could be coming to a store near you soon. And Bobby Carbonell's all right with that.
We love the craft beer industry. We want to see it keep growing, and, you know, if they can legalize the 64-ounce growler and make the breweries more competitive and help us do a little bit more business, that'd be great.
But if past experience is any guide, there are still plenty of twists and turns along the way. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
You're listening to Capital Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, Florida is a seething hotbed of college football bowl games this year. A total of 8 such games, which began in Miami back on Monday of this week, will wind up in Jacksonville on January 2nd. Most of the bowls are fairly well known to fans. But Lottie Watts with member station WUSF in Tampa tells us one game, which is being played tonight, by the way, has a new name, which officials and fans hope will be more or less permanent.
It used to be called the Beef O'Brady's Bowl, sponsored by a familiar sports bar and restaurant that got its start in Brandon, Florida. Now, the college football bowl game played at Tropicana Field is called the Bitcoin Bowl. Beef O'Brady's, yeah, most of us know that right away. But Bitcoin?
I'm Ashley Wheeler with the ESPN St. Petersburg Bitcoin Bowl, and I represent our title sponsor, BitPay.
Turns out, Bitcoin is a form of digital currency you can buy online. Wheeler says it works all over the world, from Germany to Amsterdam to Florida.
They actually have a wallet set up on their phone with any of our wallet companies that work with Bitcoin. They have their wallet. The merchant has their tablet or a smartphone that they use. We also work with a few other software companies that actually have Bitcoin through BitPay already installed in their systems, and it's just a button. They scan their QR code, they confirm the payment, and then the Bitcoin is transferred from one account to another.
The football game between North Carolina State and the University of Central Florida will be broadcast on ESPN, putting the name Bitcoin on a national stage.
I personally know I did some research back when I heard that Bitcoin was going to be the title sponsor of the bowl, just to get more information on what Bitcoins were and that sort of thing. And we've actually even talked about making sure that our players know what it is.
That's Andy Seeley, the Assistant Director for Athletics Communications at UCF in Orlando.
I know our team and our fans are very excited about going over to St. Petersburg and playing in the Bitcoin St. Petersburg Bowl. It's our third trip over to that bowl game, and each year it's been under a different name, but each year has been a great experience. They do a really great job over there, and we're looking forward to it. It's certainly good for our fans that they can make a quick, easy trip over to St. Petersburg and catch a really great game.
The UCF football team got to the Bitcoin Bowl in somewhat stunning fashion. Here's a recap from ESPN of the final moments of UCF's last regular season game against East Carolina University.
51-yard Hail Mary for the win. UCF wins 32-30. They clinch a share of the AAC conference title.
The UCF Knights will face a different team from North Carolina at the Bitcoin Bowl on December 26th. The North Carolina State Wolfpack out of Raleigh. It will be the third meeting between the teams, and both schools are hoping to see Tropicana Field filled with their colors. Black and gold for UCF, red, white, and black for the Wolfpack. Fans for either team shouldn't be too hard to come by. Here's Celia again with UCF.
We have players from all over the I-4 corridor, including over that direction, so I'm sure a lot of them are going to be happy to be playing at home in front of friends and family as well.
More than half of the UCF football players are from Florida, and North Carolina State's roster has a dozen players who come from cities in the Sunshine State, from Pahokee to Plantation to St. Petersburg. If you're looking to go to the Bitcoin Bowl, know this. You can use the digital currency Bitcoin to buy tickets, but no, you don't have to. But once you're inside the Trop, only good old-fashioned cash or credit accepted. I'm Lottie Watts in Tampa.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, and Regan McCarthy. We also thank our contributing Florida public radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report, and join us throughout the new year for more reports from the state capitol. Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, helping donors make a difference through planned giving, putting donations to work so people with disabilities can too. On the web at abletrust.org. The Able Trust. Empowerment. Education. Employment. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.